This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I'm filling in today for your usual host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. We really appreciate you joining us on Trumpet Hour today, and our panel of trumpet writers have some big stories rounded up that they're anxious to tell you all about. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And Anthony Chibadidwe.
Hello there.
Joining us from our office in the United Kingdom, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
Well, tensions in the Strait of Hormuz remain high. This is a sea gate that has been called the world's most important oil artery, since more than a third of the world's seaborne oil passes through it. And to tell us about the latest developments in this volatile waterway, we'll go to our man there in the Middle East, Brent Noctegal.
This waterway, as you said, is extremely important, especially in our day and age when oil is one of the main drivers for global economy. And as you said, around 30% of oil comes through, seaborne oil comes through this area, through the Persian Gulf and the Straits of Hormuz on the open seas. And right now, this territory has held extreme geopolitical importance. If you can control this strait, you can control the oil. And the oil market right now is suffering from, some are saying it could be oversupplied if OPEC allowed it to be. But right now, there are some limiting factors to it, especially because Iran's oil is going to come under sanctions really soon. And so we've got a coalescing of these different factors, the oil situation, and then the fact that these sanctions are going to be put on Iranian oil soon. The U.S. is saying to its allies, don't buy any Iranian oil, and the U.S. has threatened to stop them shipping it. And Iran has said, if you stop us being allowed to sell it on the open market, then we are going to close the Straits of Hormuz for everybody else. Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Qatar, and so nobody is going to be able to send their oil through here. And this week, because of that rhetoric, because the United States has been saying that they're going to do this, and Iran's countermeasure, or said that they are going to shut it down, they have actually started training for such a military action. Starting yesterday, on Thursday, there were a number of attack boats. I think there's about 100 of them actually doing these maneuvers. They're small attack boats. I would say they probably fit about 10 men on them. These are similar boats that have been used when we saw American soldiers being taken, British soldiers being taken inside the Persian Gulf in years past. They use these attack boats and they harass tankers going through the Straits of Hormuz, which is just 30 kilometers wide, so it's quite narrow, and the borders on Iran to the north and Oman to the south. And so they've started this military maneuver, and as it seems, to practice shutting down the straits, and something that they've said that they would do in the event the United States does follow through on its word.
So Iran has made this threat before, but they've never followed through on it because it would actually be, you know, a damaging move for the Iranian economy as well. It's kind of an imprecise weapon in that way. They could antagonize the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and others, but it would also result in a lot of harm to their own economy. Do you think this time it could be a different situation, that they would actually be willing to incur that damage? And if so, why?
Yeah, well, we have seen the Straits of Hormuz been shut down before because of military action. Tank has been blown up right in the Straits, and that has really affected. I think it was in the early 80s is when that happened. I would say Iran this time, there is reason to believe that they would act in this way. Turkey has said that they would be willing to buy up a lot of Iran's oil via pipeline. So that might be a way out for them if they do close the straits. They do have quite a lot of money in foreign reserve right now, at least some that they could tap that could get them by for 6 months without making any oil sales. And so there is every reason to believe that they could do this. Plus the fact that, you know, it does seem that Iran is being pushed back into a corner here. The United States is hoping that sanctions bring them back to the table, to the negotiating table, to try and moderate them. But given the fact that the Iranian regime is so entrenched right now in Iran, they hold complete power over the population, even though you do see a lot of people that don't want the Iranian regime to rule inside Iran, and they're protesting, as even we talked about on Wednesday's show. They don't have the power to overthrow the regime. And so with this regime in power, I don't think that they could be induced to coming back to the negotiating table, and therefore they might. They might just close the straits and take a hit. As they like to say, you love to live, we love to die. That's one of the mottos of the IRGC, who are doing this military action right now in the Strait of Hormuz. And so they're willing to take a hit if it serves their purpose in the long run.
Wow. Yeah, difficult to face soldiers who are eager to be martyred. What has the response from other nations in the region been? What has Israel, what has the U.S. said about this, Saudi Arabia, others?
Right. So it's interesting because last week, the strait on the other side of the Persian Gulf, the Bab el-Mandab, where about 5 million barrels of oil pass per day as opposed to the 18 that go through the Persian Gulf. So it's still very important. That was, there were a couple of attacks on Saudi tankers holding 2 million barrels each. And because of that, Saudi Arabia said, we're done shipping, at least temporarily shipping through the Bab el-Mandab. And at that time, you had the United States saying that, well, we're going to guarantee freedom of navigation through these areas. And that included the Straits of Hormuz, as well as the Bab el-Mandab. And so the international community has said, well, we have to keep this open and we're willing to go to war for that. And what's interesting is Israel, the Prime Minister of Israel, came out and said exactly that this week as well, referring to the Bab el-Mandab being closed if Iran did try to fully close that. Israel said that we're willing to send our navy in as part of the international community, which would put Israeli warships fighting alongside the Saudis and the US, which would, you know, that hasn't happened before. Saudi Arabia has been an enemy of Israel for a long, long time. So this is getting, while it's not getting that much international press attention, there are governments from around the world that are standing up and paying attention.
Hmm. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
We often talk about the push that Iran is going to make on, as this biblical king of the south, on Europe. And one of those, a couple of factors contribute to that. Perhaps a push, an Iranian push on Jerusalem would motivate Europeans to act against Iran. We expect that. We also expect the push to happen in the arena of oil, of Iran using its geographic location to jeopardize trade that travels from, including oil, from the Persian Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz, through the Bab el-Mandab into Europe. And so we expect Iran to push at Europe, and this would be a number one way that they could do that. And so if somebody wants to read more about this, they can go ahead and read an article entitled Iran Gets a Stranglehold on the Middle East. How do they do that? They do that through controlling these strategic waterways.
Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. Well, you've probably heard that last month in the World Cup, Croatia defeated England and advanced to the final. That was the first time Croatia ever made it to the World Cup final. And even though they ended up losing to France, it was still enough to stir up all kinds of far-right fervor. And when you consider Croatia's history of alignment with Nazi Germany during World War II, this new wave of Croatian fervor takes on some very disturbing significance. To tell us about this, we'll go to our man in Europe, Richard Palmer.
Yes, this far-right fervor in Croatia is in the news this week, largely thanks to Israeli Prime Minister Reuven Rivlin. He visited the country this week, and he called them out quite strongly on how much of this World War II fascist era politics is glorified in Croatia. So one of the big things that he drew attention to and that others have been looking at is the victory party that Croatia held for when they became second in the World Cup, when they made it to the final. It was a huge event. Croatia is a pretty small country. I think it's just about 4 million people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 4 million people. And 200,000 came to the victory party.
That's an incredible percentage.
Yeah. Yeah, that's like 5% of the country.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, maybe there were people from other countries coming to that as well, but that is huge. And at this huge party, there the right front and center were some really disturbing personalities. They said that it was going to be completely unpolitical. They knew that there was a danger of, or that people were kind of worried about the far right being having attention at this event because of some of the chants of Croatia's football players. They'd obviously they're playing in Russia, and I think they played Russia on the way to the final, and Croatia and Russia were on opposite sides of World War II, actually, the Croatia-England game was kind of fun to watch because one of the Croatian players had – well, it was fun to watch because of the football, but one of the Croatian players had made some comments about Ukraine. And so the Russian crowd was booing him every time he had the ball. The Russians were – I mean, England and Russia don't have great relations right now, but the Russians were so annoyed by Croatia's behavior in the World Cup with World War II era chants and things. They were cheering for England.
The enemy of my enemy game. Kind of a thing there.
Exactly. But they had this one of the big performers at this party anyway was a popular singer in Croatia. He's nicknamed Thompson because he used to carry a Tommy gun during the wars in the 90s. And he was singing some songs, and his songs he opens his concerts with basically the Croatian equivalent of Sieg Heil. His songs have all of these World War II era slogans, World War II era lyrics. And you see this a lot in Croatia. I mean, I think we talked about on this show, and I was writing on this show a few weeks ago about a massive event organized by the Catholic Church where it was the same thing. All of these World War II era slogans, World War II era lyrics and things like that just everywhere. And I think, you know, what it is the Nazis are quite rightly taboo, and everyone knows what Sieg Heil means. It even though it's literally, you know, Heil to victory, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with the words Heil to victory, everyone knows Sieg Heil, you know, Nazis, racists, gas chambers, etc. With the Croatians and the Croatian Ustashi, which was kind of their equivalent to the Nazis, there's not the same taboo. When people go up and they start shouting the Croatian equivalent of Sieg Heil, mm-hmm. Everyone over there knows what it means, but in the West, for the homeland ready, you just go, well, what's wrong with that? For the homeland ready, what's so bad? But it's the same as Sieg Heil. And the Ustashi in Croatia were, if anything, worse than the Nazis in terms of their brutality. And they killed, I think it was about 20% of their Jewish population. They were...
Wow.
Yeah, they were absolutely, completely on board with what the Nazis were doing. There was no, it wasn't just to say kind of appease the Nazis or, you know, okay, well, if we give them our Jews, we'll get concessions from them. It was, they completely endorsed their agenda. They killed massive amounts of Serbians. And so it's just a really, you know, it's a really disturbing trend when you see these type of people being glorified in front of 5% of Croatia's population. It shows that there is just this appetite for Nazism still there. And that's why I think this whole thing is so interesting, is it's, you know, it's kind of, you know, nobody can say, yeah, the Nazis were good. But now you've got in the Ustashi, you have an organization that was every bit as bad as the Nazis without the taboo, without the common knowledge. And so it's kind of like, well, what do people – to see what people really think about the Nazis, you can see how they treat the Ustashi. You know, if they genuinely disagreed and opposed the Nazis, they would oppose the Ustashi. if they kind of in their heart of hearts don't really mind the Nazis and agree with what they're doing, then they'll draw close to the Ustashi because they don't. There's no taboo to keep them away. And you see Croatia, you see huge amounts embracing that Ustashi past. You see in Austria, that where they have their big Ustashi festival, even lots of Austrians embracing that. You see the Catholic Church organizing a festival for these far-right individuals, for the Ustashi. So, you know, we like to think that Nazism was in the past and that nobody in modern Europe would support Nazi ideals. Well, we can look at an organization that literally has Nazi ideals, and they have a much higher level of support than you would expect.
Well, this really is a disturbing trend, and it's surprising that it's not getting more, you know, attention in the Western presses. But it's, you know, I'm thankful that the Israeli president there is calling them out on this, because it really is disturbing. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just tell us what you would point listeners to if they'd like to understand the dangers of this underlying far-right kind of sentiment that is still extant very much in parts of Europe?
Yeah, our free book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, is a great place to go on this. And it talks about that history specifically with the Ustashi in there. There's some passages that go over the type of crimes that they committed. But more importantly, it puts what happened with the Ustashi, what happened with the Nazis, in context of 2,000 years of European history. And what happened with there was not a one-off. It probably was more brutal than happened at other times. But you just have this consistent history within Europe of extremist regimes coming to power, of brutal regimes coming to power that enforce a religious orthodoxy. I mean, the Ustashi were very closely tied to the Catholic Church. They still are today, their leaders met with and had the support of the Pope back in World War II. So you've got this history of extremism, of intolerance of other religions and other backgrounds. It's been resurrected many times in Europe's past, and that booklet goes through that. And then it also talks about the Bible, what the Bible prophesies, that there will be one more resurrection in Europe as well. And that's both sobering, that you've got these type of extremists are coming to Europe, that extremism is still around, and there's the potential for it to rise up again. But there's also a really hopeful message as well, because you've seen this repeated resurrections of this type of evil, and the Bible says it's only going to happen one more time. It's going to be more brutal than any time before, but it's just going to happen one more time, and then finally that type of thinking will be blotted out forever.
So it is sobering to see this, but there's a lot of hope also tied to this news that we're seeing happen. And we'll be sure to have a link in our show notes to the Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy for any listeners who haven't read that. We would highly recommend it. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. Chinese money is buying great power in Sri Lanka. And it's actually only one of numerous locations where China is using its economic power to secure global trade routes, just to increase its options also for future naval bases. To understand the significance of this trend and what's going on there in Sri Lanka, we'll go to Anthony Chibadidwe.
Sri Lanka has become a case study of how Chinese money and clout have the capability to buy favors and concessions. Those were not my words. Those were the words from the Asia Times. And they, like many other observers, and like we have been talking about and writing about, we have been seeing this trend of China using its economic muscle to buy favors and buy a lot more influence in various parts of the world, particularly in this part of the world, which is very important for China to control sea gates. Brent was talking earlier about sea gates there in the Middle East, but China is trying to control those gates, those sea lanes in South Asia, Southeast Asia. in Sri Lanka, well, Sri Lanka is located along China's cherished routes of ports and sea lanes and highways that they call the String of Pearls. And it's this strategic location just in the Indian Ocean, just about 30 miles south of India's southwestern coastline, that just makes it very crucial for Chinese trade and projecting power abroad. And China has been using, like we said, its economic muscle to buy influence. Now, many countries do that. Many countries provide aid to other countries to hopefully gain something in return. Sometimes it's peace, sometimes it's a good market for their products. But in this case for China, it's just very remarkable because they have actually placed Sri Lanka in a debt trap, essentially just piling a lot of money, giving it a lot of money to borrow, and then trapping them and then demanding favors in return. Now, the latest is from July 21st. This was actually a groundbreaking ceremony for the construction of a Chinese-funded kidney hospital. And the president of Sri Lanka, Sirisena, he announced this. Here's his quote. He said, "When the Chinese ambassador visited my house to fix the date for this ceremony, he said that the Chinese president Xi Jinping sent me another gift." So there have been a lot of these gifts coming to the Sri Lankan leaders. And he said he has gifted 2 billion yuan, which is about $295 million, to be utilized for any project of my wish. And he is going to build houses with that money. But just 2 days later, another Chinese military official announced that China will be giving even more gifts, a warship, and some experts believe that it's going to provide a whole lot more. And that's how China is trying to build a lot of influence in China, even providing some of these military equipment that are going to require Chinese servicemen. And already China has secured an important port in Sri Lanka, Hambantota. And what's interesting about this port is that under the previous president of Sri Lanka, Sri Lanka got a lot of Chinese funds to work on it. No one was interested in it, but the Chinese were the ones who showed interest in providing this money. And that president of Sri Lanka, he was removed from power in an election, and the new president came in just telling people that I'm going to move away from China, I'm going to break away from China. But China had just become so deeply involved in this country that it was just impossible. It was just impossible to do that. The debts had to be paid. And when it came time to pay for the debts for Hambantota, Sri Lanka just didn't have the money. And they just caved into Chinese influence and just leased the port to China for 99 years. So that's just a good example of how China is increasing its influence there.
Yeah, it really does seem to be advancing China's string of pearls strategy. Could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Well, Bible prophecy does talk about China in various places. It talks about it being part of this mot of nations that has a strong control on trade through control of important trade routes. And it also talks about China being part of these kings of the East that have immense military power. And what we are seeing right now is China just fitting that description more and more. It's cementing its control in all these important seaports, and it's also building up its military. And we all need to just continue watching China fulfill these Bible prophecies. And for anyone who wants to read more about this, we have an article that talks about this trend. It's called "Why the Trumpet Watches the Rise of China as a Superpower." And another piece of literature that our listeners can read is "Russia and China in Prophecy."
And Anthony has also written an article, which is up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's called China Expands Economic and Military Influence in Sri Lanka. So we'll have a link to that article as well as the two pieces of literature that he just mentioned there in the show notes. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. And just about all of the stories that we are talking about today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be published there soon if they're not there yet. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more information on these important stories. We'll take a break in just a moment, but first we'll discuss one more story, and that is that California is suffering some of the most destructive wildfires in its history right now, with Governor Jerry Brown saying just a couple of days ago that the heat wave that is exacerbating these fires so much is the worst in the history of civilization. Governor Brown says those heat conditions will only get worse. To bring us up to speed on this disaster, we'll go to trumpet writer Andrew Miller.
It's the Carr wildfire in Shasta County started on July 23rd, and it's already grown to become the largest wildfire of 2018 so far. It's burned over 1,200 buildings and six people. According to the state's Forest and Fire Protection Agency, the fire was ignited by a vehicular failure. And it's, as you mentioned before, it's become one of the 10 most destructive wildfires in California's history, having burnt down over 100,000 acres. And there was one man, we have an article up this on our website by Michael Davis that relays the story of one man who had his great-grandchildren burned to death in this fire as he it just came across the area and cut him off from getting back to the house. And it has just been exacerbated by a drought that's made California's rainfall vastly less than it normally is, which is something definitely saying something for a state that's been in drought for some time.
Right.
And these things are becoming more common and getting worse. There's actually some research they cite in that article talking about how the number of acres burned by fire in California has doubled since the 90s. In the early 2000s, the average number of buildings destroyed by wildfires was 2,300 per year. But by 2010, the average was double that to 4,300 per year. And like I said, with about a quarter of that being burnt in this one fire alone, meaning this year could well pass that if you get a couple more big wildfires throughout the remaining months.
You mentioned the article by Michael Davis that's up on the website right now. That article is called California's Fiery Trials, The Real Cause. Could you talk a little bit about what that real cause for these fires is?
Yeah, this is a common theme that comes up on this radio program and on our website about the real cause behind fires. You go look into verses throughout the Bible, and like Leviticus 23, where God promises rain in due season and favorable weather conditions for his obedience to his laws, which mandates that if there's drought or if there's fires or if there's natural disasters, that those promises aren't being fulfilled, which means that it's not God who let down on his side of the covenant. It's the people who've let down on their side of keeping God's law that is the root cause behind things like this. And there's many other verses throughout the Bible. There's one particular one that's very specific to this type of situation in Isaiah 33. It goes from like verses 7 through verses 14. But it starts talking, it says, "Behold, the valiant ones shall cry without, the ambassadors of peace shall weep bitterly." And then if you skip down a couple verses, "And the people shall be as the burning of lime, as thorns cut out shall they be burned up in fire. Hear you afar off, what have I done? Ye that will here acknowledge my might, the sinners of Zion are afraid. Fearfulness has surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell in the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings?" And then a few verses later, it reiterates that same point I made from Leviticus about, like, if you're walk righteously and speak uprightly, these curses won't come on you. But that's just a very specific verse that's talking about the ambassadors of peace weeping bitterly. So it's not like some sort of verse about hell, like a lot of Christian organizations may teach, but very specific. They know that this is a place where there's ambassadors of peace and a nation that's disobeying God, and they're dealing with this just ever burning continuous fires throughout their nation because of those sins.
Really does paint an accurate picture of what we're seeing there. It's just a heartbreaking situation to see. But we will have a link to Michael Davis's article, California's Fiery Trials, The Real Cause. We'll also provide a link there to our free booklet, Why Natural Disasters, which just takes a deep dive into these various scriptures explaining a lot of the curses that we're seeing happening in the U.S. today. You're listening to Trumpet Hour here on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial. The live stream's available anywhere in the world if you just type kpcg.fm into your internet browser. Coming up, we'll discuss Germany's disappearing debt, rising tensions in Jerusalem, an explosive election in Zimbabwe, and the inflation rate in Venezuela soaring into the stratosphere. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
This is Jeremiah Jacques filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Benjamin Franklin famously said, "It's better to go to bed supperless than to rise in debt." They're wise words, but very difficult to live by, not just for individuals, but also for nations. At present, every major economy on the planet owes considerably more than it can afford, which could bring about all kinds of serious problems for these countries. Yet most of them just keep on spending and getting in deeper and deeper. But there's one European country with a booming economy that is bucking this trend and tackling its debt rapidly. To talk about this, we'll go once again to Richard Palmer.
Yes, I have the very rare privilege of bringing some good news. Good economic news, at least if you live in Germany. Germany is getting rid of its debt. I think it's a really interesting contrast. So this week you had more news from the US Treasury, where they said they were expecting to issue around $800 billion of new debt in the second half of this year, which is far higher than they thought they were going to be issuing. So America's debt, or America's planned borrowing, is unexpectedly increasing. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in Germany, you have the opposite. Germany's economy actually paid off more debt than they were expecting. So not only are they borrowing, they're not just not borrowing as much, they're paying off their debt. Their debt is shrinking. They have got their debt below 2 trillion euros, which is the first time since they kind of changed the way they calculated their debt in 2010 that it's fallen under that 2 trillion mark. It's coming as their economy is stronger than they expected. So they shrunk their debt by 2.1%. Meanwhile, America is increasing its debt by, I think it's getting up close to, around 5.5% it's forecast to be by 2020. So just quite the contrast between the two. And it's not just the federal debt. I mean, the federal debt is going down, but then even the states within Germany are also paying down their debt. One state, for example, Saxony, they managed to cut their debt by 16%. Baden-Württemberg, they decreased their public debt by 13%. So some remarkable economic news there.
Yeah, and as you said, it really does contrast very starkly with what you see, not just in the U.S., as you mentioned, but in just so many major economies. China's struggling with debt quite a lot at present. The Russian economy is faltering in some ways that are really presenting some challenges to the leadership. But with Germany, it's the opposite picture. what would you say that this decreasing debt for Germany means for its power within Europe and also just in the greater global arena?
I think the big thing, the big effect that it has is on how easily Germany will be able to recover from a financial crisis. In some way, like, Germany's economy still has problems and still has some pretty big problems. We've talked on this show, for example, about how reliant they are on exports.
Right.
And so that means if you have a financial crisis in America, it could travel to Germany quickly. But if you're not so reliant on debt, it's much easier to bounce back from those crises if you don't have that kind of ball and chain around your neck. And if you need to borrow money to balance your budget, then you always need to be trying to seek lenders, look for the approval of lenders. If you're in Germany's position where you don't need to borrow money, I mean, Germany could say tomorrow, they could say, we're not going to pay back any of our debt. No one would lend them any money if they said that, because they wouldn't want to risk all their debt getting wiped out again. But they don't need anyone to lend them money. It puts you in a big position of strength. Now, if there was an economic downturn, I'm sure they would have to borrow money as well. But being able to shrink that debt and being able to pay that, I mean, they're mending the roof while the sun is out. It means that it doesn't mean that it's not going to rain, but it means that when it does start raining, Germany is going to be in a far better position and probably be able to bounce back far better because of this.
Could you put this news from Germany in the context of Bible prophecy for us and just let listeners know what they could read if they wanted to understand more about it?
Sure. So one of the big prophecies that we're watching, the main prophecies that we're watching, is the rise of this European power, this power that's, you know, a Europe dominated by Germany. And the Bible tells us that it's happening. We talked a bit about that in the first half. And a lot of the scriptures that talk about this power talk about it being an economic power. So Revelation 17 is one of the key prophecies that talks about an empire that has a religious component that's constantly resurrected. And Europe is the only place that matches that description. And Revelation 18 goes on to describe how the merchants of the earth rejoice with this power and they mourn when it's destroyed. You know, it has a very strong economic component. There are other scriptures that talk about its strong economic component in the Old Testament. Isaiah 23 is one that we talk about a lot. And so you can see Germany kind of even getting ready to be that economic power, the groundwork being laid. You can see America's debt really undermining its economic strength already. And then you can see that economic strength building in Europe. And that same book that I pointed to in the first half, The Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy, is a great place to go to understand more of that. Like I said, it talks a lot about that history, but there is a strong chapter on what's prophesied to come to Europe. And it goes, takes you through all of the Bible scriptures that describe this coming power. And it shows you why they apply to this coming European power. So that Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy is just a great place to go to understand what's happening right now in Germany and Europe.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. On Monday, Palestinian religious authorities in East Jerusalem issued a religious decree, or a fatwa, that bans Arab residents from participating in the upcoming municipal elections in Jerusalem. To explain why this could really heighten the tensions over Jerusalem, we'll go once again to Brent.
Yeah, this fatwa is interesting because we have in Jerusalem about 300,000 Arabs that are eligible to vote. And if they did vote, this could really shake up the town hall. This could really change the mayoral race completely if they did vote for one candidate, because the Jews are normally pretty divided on the candidates that they pick. But there has long since been a boycott by most of the Arabs, by far the great majority of the Arabs, from even participating in these, as they see it as legitimizing the Israeli hold over Jerusalem, a city that they consider consider theirs. But this year we had an Arab candidate that has decided that he would like to run for the municipal office in Jerusalem. Ramadan Dabash is his name. And his announcement, as well as the push, it seems, that there were going to be some Arabs that would start voting on this, we had a religious decree come down that said no, you can't do this. You cannot vote in this election. You can't be a candidate in this election. And here's a religious decree that says that you can't. And to break these, this is considered quite serious if you're a follower of Islam. This has gone through a council process, and this is obviously something that would have been discussed with other religious figures across the Middle East, and they have deemed it against Islam, basically, to even participate in the municipal elections. This is interesting because another fatwa was released or made by the Sheikh, Sheikh Mohammed Hussein, the Mufti of Jerusalem. He made another religious decree 2 weeks ago, saying that if you sell your home, your property anywhere in the state of Israel to a Jew and you're Palestinian, you are breaking religious law, Islamic law. And in fact, you are as bad as an infidel if you do that. We deem all of Palestine, especially Jerusalem, as a holy site. Therefore, it does not, you cannot sell it to a non-Muslim. And so you've got both of these religious decrees being handed down in quick succession over Jerusalem that I feel is increasing the religious fervor behind, or the religious motivation behind, or infusing, let's say, the Palestinian-Israeli issue with religion more and more, which is extremely volatile.
Yes, it really does sound like an incredibly volatile situation to feel like, you know, for these individuals to feel like if they sell their house to a Jewish person, they, what, miss out on heaven or whatever their belief may be there. Could you talk a little
and
bit about...
And they're also ostracized completely they do this. And, I mean, a lot of the time, if they're going to have... Already, if you're going to sell your property to a Jew in a sensitive location in the city, I mean, you're getting a lot of money for that, enough for you to get out of Dodge, because your family will disown you. There has been physical violence done to these people by the Palestinian authorities, and so it's a very serious ordeal.
So they're punished both in this life and, you know, they would believe in the next as well. Could you talk a little bit about how this connects to Bible prophecy, and about what literature you would recommend for listeners who would like to understand it better?
Well, we do see Jerusalem as a thermometer for world events because Bible prophecy revolves around this city so much. There are key prophecies that talk about how, as a precursor to other end time events, or the very first one, the first domino to fall, being half of Jerusalem falling to the Palestinians in an armed uprising, not just being given over in some type of peace negotiation. And the thing that always motivates the Palestinians to come out and fight, it is not a nationalistic goal of having half of Jerusalem to be their capital or having a state of Palestine. That doesn't motivate people to come out and fight. It is always a perceived threat to the religion of Islam, the holy sites of Islam. And so by infusing religion into land ownership, by infusing religion into even voting in Jerusalem's election, you are increasing, you're making this situation that's already dangerous more volatile, and giving more people reason to be motivated to try and take Jerusalem itself. And so this is something that's very serious, and it does have prophetic implications. And to read up about those prophetic implications, I would bring people to an article that was written back in 2006, and it's entitled "Jerusalem is About to Be Cut in Half," and it shows you about the fact that when people start talking about Islamic sites and the sway that they should, the hold that the Muslims should have on them in Jerusalem, that's when we should be watching for half of the city to fall.
Brent has also covered this in the latest This Week from Jerusalem video. We'll be sure to have a link to that video in the show notes, and I would encourage you to subscribe to that series and just check them out, because it is vital for each of us to watch Jerusalem, and this series can really help us to watch the city closely and just to stay apprised of all the significant developments there. Well, thanks very much for that, Brent. Zimbabwe has just held its elections, and it is a historic election for a few different reasons. To tell us about the latest developments there in his home country, we'll go to Anthony Chibadidwe.
Yes, it's a landmark. It has been a landmark election because it's the first one in Zimbabwe that didn't have President Robert Mugabe or Robert Mugabe as one of the candidates. And the reason why he wasn't a candidate is because he was removed from power. But we'll get back to that in a little bit.
Sounds like it's difficult for you to even say his name without saying president at the beginning, because for your entire life, I guess.
Exactly. It has always been President Mugabe. Right. President Mugabe. Well, yesterday it was declared that Emmerson Mnangagwa was the winner. I didn't say he won. That's what was declared. Big difference. So it was announced that he won 50.8% of the vote. And by many indications, it wasn't a free and fair election. Even before the elections, there were complaints about how much influence the government of Emmerson Mnangagwa had on the Zimbabwean Electoral Commission. The government manipulated the ballot paper to make Mnangagwa more prominent on that ballot paper. And there were the usual complaints about intimidating voters in rural areas and using food aid as potential weapons. Now, we do need to remember again that this is the man who came into power through a military coup back in November. And when that coup happened, or just before it happened, we had one of the army commanders visiting China. And many analysts believe that he went there to seek approval from China, not the U.S., not Britain, but China, for the green light to go on with the coup. And when they took over, when he came back, he was supposed to be arrested, actually, by Mugabe, but he ended up conducting the coup. And they made it look like it wasn't a coup. They made Robert Mugabe just seem like he just resigned. But it was indeed a coup. And they just, this just reminds us that it's all about the optics that mattered most to them. And on Sunday, just the day before the election, Robert Mugabe gave a press conference saying that he was forced to resign. It was indeed a coup. He said that himself, and he said that there was absolutely no way he was going to vote for Mnangagwa. He actually characterized him as a liar and a brutal leader who has been tormenting him.
It seems like that could be dangerous for Mugabe to come out and admit that he was forced to resign, just given the fact that, you know, the power now lies in the hands of this man who he's really vocally opposing.
I think that also shows that everyone, including Mugabe, just knew that there was no chance that Mnangagwa would win a free and fair election. Mm. A lot of people had a lot of confidence in the opposition party. But here's something to think about. If Mugabe himself, who was brutal, thinks that Mnangagwa is brutal, that says a lot. And I've also heard that Mnangagwa's government has intimidated some rural folk by reminding them that Mnangagwa and his people were the only ones who were strong enough and brutal enough to be able to kick Mugabe out. So they kind of used that to warn people. And so people did vote on Monday, and the Electoral Commission delayed announcing the results. People naturally got upset about that. They started demonstrating, and the government must have anticipated that. But instead of using the police to deal with the demonstrators, they did get a little violent. People were burning tires and cars. But instead of just using the police, the government deployed the army, which started shooting at people. There is a video online of a masked soldier who is going down on his knees like he's in a military battlefield and is shooting at people. And another soldier had to slap him in the back to stop. Mm-hmm. In the end, at least six people were killed. And many believe that the army decided to use force just to make sure that no one dared to contest the results, which were finally announced last night at 11 p.m., late in the evening, when most people are in their houses and just getting ready for bed. So that's how the situation is. The opposition is contesting the results. We are not sure exactly how that's going to happen, but we can know that this government is determined to just go strong. And if they have friends like China, they might survive. Even if the whole world disagrees with the results, they might survive. Just wanted to comment on the opposition, because throughout this election season, they have been campaigning and bringing God in it. In fact, one of their slogans, that their campaign slogans, was "God is in it." The opposition president is, I think he was ordained a pastor in 2016, and there's been a lot of hope. People calling out to God and just wanting him to be involved in the election, hence the "God is in it." And it is true, God is in it, but just not the way people realize. It is true, because in Daniel 4 verse 17, it says that it talks about God reassuring the living that they might know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomsoever ye will, and sets up over it the basest of men. Mr. Joe Flory wrote about it in his book, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, and he said this: "We shouldn't be too impressed by the leaders of this world. God rules them and sets up whomever he will in order to fulfill his master plan. Sometimes even the basest of men rule because God put them there or allowed them to be there in order to fulfill his purpose. He allows all kinds of things to happen, but everything occurs in the context of his master plan." So there's good news for Zimbabweans and any other country out there that feels like they're not getting the right kind of leadership. True leadership is coming, and indeed God is in it.
Well, thanks very much for that, Anthony. It's really valuable just to have an insider's perspective on everything that's happening there, and we'll be sure to have a link to Daniel Unlocks Revelation in our show notes, which does just do an amazing job of giving perspective on the perfect leadership that is coming soon. Well, our final story today is about the socialist paradise of Venezuela. It's actually, of course, not at all a paradise there, but it's just, we see a really tragic unraveling of the economy, which is bringing with it all kinds of other social problems for the Venezuelan people. Trumpet writer Andrew Miller has written about this for thetrumpet.com, and he says that as the crisis weakens the socialist regime of Nicolas Maduro, it's actually strengthening the Roman Catholic Church. Andrew, maybe you could start off just by giving us the details of the hyperinflation situation there in Venezuela.
Yeah, right now Venezuela is suffering one of the worst hyperinflation crises in history. The country's annual inflation rate hit 46,000% last month.
Wow.
Food prices are doubling every 2 weeks. And according to the International Monetary Fund, the annual inflation rate is projected to top 1,000,000% by the end of the year. That's not quite as bad as it was in Zimbabwe 10 years ago, but it's almost as bad as it was in Weimar Germany in the 1920s. They said it now takes 1,000,000 bolivars to buy a cup of coffee, 2.5 million bolivars to buy a dozen eggs.
So if somebody used cash for those kinds of purchases, they'd pretty much have to go, to Starbucks or wherever with a wheelbarrow full of banknotes.
The biggest note they have right now is 100,000 bolivars. So it would take 100,000 bolivars to get your coffee or like 25 of them. So you're getting a lot. But yeah, if you were to purchase something more expensive than coffee, I mean, you could be very well be in a car or something like that. You'd be in a wheelbarrow scenario.
Yeah.
So far, the government's master plan to solve this crisis is to reissue new bolivars with 5 zeros deleted off the banknote. So, which basically makes it so your 100,000 bolivar bill becomes your new bolivar bill, but money's still losing value at an escalating rate.
Yeah.
Just bringing you to the point of make the point that this and other things have basically turned Venezuela into a mafia state, in the fact that you would starve to death based off the money you earn legally.
Oh, okay.
So the only way you feed your family is by engaging in black market activity, smuggling gasoline into Colombia, smuggling drugs into the Dominican Republic, contraband in between people in the city. So it's like pretty much every, almost every Venezuelan is involved in some sort of black market activity, which is one of the significant things with this is it's really turning Venezuela into a major conduit for cocaine and other contraband in Latin America into Mexico and the United States and Europe.
Wow. So just fueling a lot of the instability in those other countries.
Right. You know, all throughout Central America and Mexico, you're getting a lot of instability coming from Venezuela. But as you mentioned at the beginning, the opposition to Maduro's regime is really turning to the Roman Catholic Church. The country's 70% Catholic. The Bishops' Conference has already officially declared Maduro as a dictator. They've condemned his economic policies that have led to hyperinflation. I think last year the Vatican unsuccessfully tried to even broker a deal with Cuba to have Maduro ousted from power and granted asylum in Cuba. In return for letting the opposition come to power in Venezuela. So we know as this economic crisis unravels, you're going to get to a situation where there's going to be much more crime, much more drug trade, much more terrorism, much more instability in Venezuela. But that instability is going to keep pushing people towards Europe and the Vatican and the Roman Catholic Church, which is the prophetic angle we have in the article online right now. Venezuela's inflation rate heads towards 1,000,000%, where it talks about prophecies in Revelation chapter 17 and 18 about a Vatican-influenced trading empire that we've said for decades will encompass both Europe and Latin America. And this is these economic crises like this are just really pushing Latin American nations like Venezuela into the arms of Germany and the Vatican.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. And we will be sure to have a link to Andrew's powerful article about this in the show notes. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Please visit us there to read more about the stories that we're discussing today and also to subscribe to our print edition and our news brief, which we send out several times each week. Tell us what you think about the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel today, Andrew Miller, Anthony Chibadidwe, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Shabbat shalom.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And we'll leave you today with some words from William Makepeace Thackeray. There are 1,000 thoughts lying within a man that he does not know till he takes up a pen to write. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.